In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
We all enjoy a little mystery. Every other week, one strange thing presents forgotten stories from America's newspaper archives. They all have something in common, a single element that can't quite be explained. Join us on One Strange Thing, and you'll hear about a man who was literally stricken with genius, a 21st century child who remembered piloting a World War II bomber, a mysterious, unidentifiable blob in Texas. And then there was the lizard man stalking through small-town South Carolina. From cryptids and disappearances to modern-day miracles, One Strange Thing brings you stories that are very real and just a little otherworldly. Subscribe now, wherever you listen.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
On this episode, a biblical prophecy researcher and documentary filmmaker believes he's located the throne of Satan.
Albert Speer walks into the museum and he sees this altar and he is inspired. He goes, you know what, I love this altar. I'm going to build a large version of it for Adolf Hitler.
If you enjoy Conspiracy Unlimited, why not become a Conspiracy Unlimited Plus member? For just $1.99 per month, you'll gain access to 2 bonus, exclusive, commercial-free episodes per month, plus access to my back catalog of episodes. To subscribe, just go to conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com and click on Gain Access to Premium Episodes. Again, go to conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com and click on Get Access to Premium Episodes, or click on the link in the episode notes. Conspiracy Unlimited Plus, for less than $2 per month. Why not sign up today?
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett. Pursuing the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from his studio beneath the stairs, here's Richard Serrett.
This episode is brought to you by Smile Brilliant. teeth whitening backed by science.
Now, my guest has been with me before on Conspiracy Unlimited. In fact, just about 2 months ago, just a few days after his episode dropped, he calls me up and he wants to meet for coffee downtown Toronto, but he doesn't tell me what it's about. So we meet and he shares with me his latest research. He says to me, now this is over green tea at Starbucks. He says, "I know where Satan's throne is." I say, "I beg your pardon? Yes, I know where Satan's throne is." Just like that. Just matter of fact. First of all, I didn't know Satan had a throne, but I suppose if you are the Dark Prince and you rule this world, and he does, you probably have a throne. And then, over the next hour, he proceeds to tell me what Satan's throne is, what it looks like, and its exact location. And now he's going to share that story with you. Are you ready? Strap yourself in. This is going to be a wild ride filled with intrigue and subterfuge. It's a tale of archaeology meets spiritual warfare. Here we go. Ali Siadatan is the founder of Think Again Productions in Canada, a multimedia teaching ministry shedding light on mysteries and treasures of scriptural knowledge, which is making the Bible more real than ever. Siadatan has found that evidence keeps agreeing with the Bible's tale, from biblical cities peering through the sand to alien abductions and prophetic events. In 2006, Think Again Productions released the groundbreaking documentary UFOs, Angels, and Gods on Google Video, and it received 270,000 views in just 9 months. Siadatan has a black belt in Kung Fu and has been training since 1991. His research into UFOs has inspired him to write a work of fiction, still in progress, as well as a second documentary on the rise of the Antichrist titled Goliath Rising, Hybrids, Nephilim, and Titans. Ali Siadatan, welcome back to Conspiracy Unlimited. How are you?
Very good, Richard. Thank you for having me back.
You and I had coffee about a month ago, and we talked about this amazing artifact that I wasn't aware of. The Altar of Zeus. Now, first of all, just give us kind of the 30,000-foot view. What does this thing look like? Where is it mentioned? Then why is it important?
Well, it has a very interesting story. It is mentioned specifically. What makes it relevant is, you know, tucked away in the Book of Revelation, there are seven letters that apparently Christ wrote himself. You know, when people think of the letters in the New Testament, they think of the letters of Paul or James or Peter, but there are actually seven letters in the New Testament that were written by Jesus himself, but they're tucked away into the Book of Revelation, which is kind of a hard book to decipher. And it's fascinating because apparently when Jesus, you know, ascends God, God gives him this information, which he then sends to his disciple John through a messenger, a heavenly messenger. So this is a communication of the highest degree. Apparently, you know, God, who inhabits eternity, explains this to his son. So this is a highest degree. And in these seven letters, he's writing to seven congregations in Asia Minor, which is kind of modern-day Turkey by the Aegean coast. And suddenly, we're all surprised to see that in one of the letters to the city of Pergamum, the congregation of followers of the Messiah in Pergamum, he says these surprising words to them. He says, "I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is, Satan's throne. Yet you hold fast my name, and you do not deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas," which were the days of persecution where the leader was killed, Antipas. "In the days of Antipas, my faithful witness, who was killed among you, where Satan dwells." And suddenly, this throne of Satan, I mean, this is fascinating, and I'll break down the story of how I came across this information, but if you're asking for a 30,000 feet view, this throne of Satan in the city of Pergamum, when archaeologists finally got there in the 19th century, at the end of the 19th century, Prussian-German archaeologist Carl Heumann specifically, he unearthed this incredibly magnificent altar to Zeus, the head of the pantheon, the father of the gods, the ruler of the Greco-Roman world, because he was also known as Jupiter to the Romans.
Right.
And it was this magnificent piece of architecture, and it was still there. When you look at temples to Zeus or altars to Zeus in the ancient world, they weren't all over the place. This was a very unique and significant piece, and in the middle of it there was an altar of burnt offering, where burnt offerings were offered to Zeus 24/7. So it was the most important spiritual monument of that city.
And where was it? How was it uncovered? It was obviously not in plain sight, so they had to unearth it. Is that the idea?
Yes, it was buried over time as the Greco-Roman empire came to a close and Rome lost its power, and it shifted from polytheism, the worship of the gods, to the worship of the one god. As this spiritual transformation came over the Roman world, this very popular and important altar was then just left and gradually was covered with dust and was buried, yet it was intact.
And what does it look like? Give me sort of the dimensions, roughly. What does it look like?
It actually looks like someone reaching out with their arms. Imagine a person reaching out with their arms, their chest in the middle, and two arms on either side. It has that shape of like a very rectangular U. And then in the middle of it, in the center of it, was an altar of burnt offering. As far as the exact dimensions, I have to look at my notes. I wasn't thinking about that. But it is basically large enough that an entire building had to be built for it in Germany, where the Ottoman Empire was controlling that area. They did some negotiations, and the Ottoman Empire agreed to let the Germans take this. They took it to Germany. And this is the interesting part. The people who brought this insisted that this altar must be reassembled just the way it was in Germany. They dismantled it piece by piece.
Sorry, just the way it was in Pergamum.
The way it was in Pergamum. They brought it to Berlin, and they said, you know what, we have to build a special structure to house this. And that structure is the Museum of Pergamum. It took 3 years to build. And if you look at it, you'll see it doesn't look like a regular museum. It really looks like a temple to me. It's a very strange building, the very heart of the museum where this thing was put.
So a museum that houses basically one artifact, and that is this altar to the Greek god Zeus. Sorry,
and yes,
did you give me the dimensions, how big this thing is?
Well, I'll have to look it up while we're talking. Another thing that's housed in that museum, as you're kind of moving towards the altar on your right hand side, you'll pass through the gates of Ishtar, which were the gates of Babylon, the very gates of Babylon, incredible gates of phenomenal fame, because the walls of Babylon were very, very wide walls. Four chariots could race on the top of it, and they were held together by these gates dedicated to the Queen of Heaven, Ishtar, and those gates are also in this museum. As you walk in deep into it, and then at the very end, past the gates, at the very end, you find this other artifact, an altar to this pagan god, and the connection with Satan is very compelling, and I'll kind of open that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how you make the connection from this letter in Revelation from Jesus to one of his churches, mentioning the throne of Satan, to the altar of Zeus. How do we know that the throne of Satan mentioned in Revelation is in fact this same altar?
Well, that is a very interesting point. It's kind of like the pieces of a puzzle coming together. The way that I came across it was in 1996. I was attending some studies of the Bible. I walked up the stairs and the teacher said to me, I know where Satan's throne is. And I said to him, well, where? He said, well, it's Pergamum. And he pointed to this letter.
Now, there's an icebreaker. Hey, I know where Satan's throne is.
No kidding. I was like, what? So I went looking to see what I could find in Pergamum, and I found myself in the Museum of Archaeology. I think it was the ROM Museum of the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto, the Library of ROM. And there, what I found was actually the notes of Carl Heumann, the archaeologist who had unearthed this. And he said in his own handwriting, it said, if Jesus was referring to anything of significance, it must have been this altar. And I thought, wow. So I ran back, I photocopied that. I said, I think, you know, the archaeologist agrees with you who dug up Pergamum. Apparently, he too feels that there was something here of importance. It was this altar of Zeus. And then fast forwarding, you know, that really opened for us the connection between, the gods and the fallen angels, because who was Zeus? The head of the pantheon of the gods, according to the Greek pantheon, and Jupiter was just his Roman name. And so was there a connection between the gods and the fallen angels? And that led us into the study of this whole matter in Scripture, which is fascinating, and you can kind of look it up in our documentary, UFOs, Angels, and Gods. A few years later, this was actually 10 years later when the documentary was released in 2006, I was in a magazine store, and there something caught my eye, the cover of Biblical Archaeology Review. It had a picture of this altar, a piece of it, and then it said Satan's throne. I thought, what? Someone else is talking about this? So I picked up, and it was a professor from Yale Seminary explaining essentially the same thing, that this was probably what Jesus must have been referring to, because this was the only thing of great architectural and spiritual importance inside of Pergamum. And you think, okay, this is interesting. Here's another person. You know, it's as though something is being discovered. Now, keep in mind that all hell has broken loose since this altar was reassembled and placed in Berlin. We've had two world wars, a Holocaust, the rise of the Soviet Empire, the Cold War, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the establishment of Israel. I mean, so much has happened.
Two Gulf Wars.
This altar appears in Berlin, and these guys who I'm looking into right now to see what spiritual, you know, connection they may have had in their own personal lives insist. They get together and they insist, they petition the authorities that this must be reassembled the way it stood in the city of Pergamum. It was not customary to exhibit archaeological finds in that way. You would just take a piece of it, put it in the museum, and the rest would be in storage, and you might rotate. But these guys insisted, no, we want this thing reassembled just the way it was. And to this end, an entire building is built, which takes 3 years to build. This thing is put inside of it. Again, once again, this phenomenal, you know, this altar that the Lord may be calling Satan's throne, and I'll explain why that may be the case.
Let me ask you something though, Ali. So, what year was that museum dedicated to Pergamum opened in Berlin?
I think it was 1897.
1897. All right. Do we know whether, for example, since we are likely talking about Satan's throne here?
Yes.
Whether Hitler or Himmler or any of his Nazi henchmen visited the museum and paid tribute to it?
Well, that's a very good question. There was an entire, you know, nefarious spiritual awakening happening in Europe, especially centered in Germany. There was, you know, the great spiritualist,
Blavatsky.
Madame Blavatsky, who was German-Russian, born in Ukraine at this time, and the whole Nazi movement was a religious movement.
Occultic, yeah, it was occultic.
A cult that was going back to, you know, pre-Christian ideas of spirituality and the channeling of all kinds of things. So while this spiritual movement is rising, which eventually will crown the Führer, his architect, Albert Speer, walks into the museum. He walks into the museum, and he sees this altar, and he is inspired. He goes, you know what, I love this altar. I'm going to build a large version of it for Adolf Hitler. And he does, in the city of Nuremberg. If you Google Nuremberg rallies,
yes,
this large structure at the back where the rallies were held, And, you know, these rallies were held at night. Hitler said that he wanted it to be as solemn as a Catholic mass. And so Albert Speer put these lights all around, and at night they would light up the lights, and the beams of light would go up, forming pillars of light. And people, you know, the soldiers would be coming in, and then at the very end of it, there was this massive version of this altar. And this is interesting. With the inside of the altar of Pergamum, the ancient altar of Pergamum, there was one of the great symbols of Zeus. Zeus had the bull as his symbol. And so in that bull, in ancient Pergamum, there would be offerings to purify the land to Zeus, other than the offerings that were on the altar, which were an act of worship. When monotheism came in the form of this messianic religion, Christianity eventually was called, to the city of Pergamum, this offended the priests of Zeus. So they went and they arrested Antipas, the leader of the congregation of Pergamum. They brought him and they offered him as a burnt offering. They put him inside of that brazen bull that was on the altar, the symbol of Zeus. They lit a fire underneath him and they cooked him inside of that bull. And they had put these tubes inside of the bull to, you know, amplify the sounds of the cries of whoever was being burnt in the bull. And historians record that Antipas, until his death, he prayed for his church, prayed for their protection while he was being cooked in there. When Albert Speer reduplicated this altar, he removed the bull, and where the bull would have stood, he put a podium for Hitler to stand and make his speeches. And it is from that podium that Hitler went ahead and called for another burnt offering, or as we say in Greek, Holocaust.
Ah, amazing. Horrible, yes. And amazing at the same time. Just the...
Yes, the connection is very eerie. And so here we have this, this connection of this spiritual movement that rises on the heels of the reappearing of the altar. The altar reappears in Berlin. It is from there that this spiritual movement rises, that has all kinds of name, theosophy, Arianism, and Hitler, it becomes a disciple of it, and eventually becomes its Führer. You know, the whole point of this movement is to actually empower a Führer. Now, when you kind of go back...
Empower an Antichrist.
A type of the Antichrist, right. For sure.
We should also point out, Ali, that for those people who if they want to see this duplicate, an enormous duplicate of the altar of Zeus built by Albert Speer, then they should Google Triumph of the Will. That's Lemmy Riefenstahl's documentary about the Nuremberg rally, and then there they will see it.
I own a copy of it, yeah, and that's a very chilling document where, you know, Hitler starts his journey in an aeroplane descending like the Messiah coming down for his 1,000-year rule. So there's all kinds of connections here of a duplicate of the Messiah or a pseudo-Messiah, definitely an Antichrist. Now, why is this a throne? Why is the throne of all the different altars that were in the ancient world to Zeus? By the way, there are not that many altars to Zeus in the ancient world. This was a unique place. And even temples, which are different beasts and altars.
Yes, I've been to Zeus's temple in Athens. What remains of it? Giant,
yes.
I guess, Corinthian pillars, some of them toppled over. It's spectacular nonetheless. One other question, though, before we proceed. When Jesus was writing these seven letters to the churches that are revealed in Revelation, and he's calling out the church in Pergamum, and he's saying that the throne is there. At this point, Pergamum is Christian.
Pergamum is not Christian.
It's not.
Pergamum just has a tiny Christian community living in it.
Got it. Okay. And
yes.
And the altar is still being used by the pagans at this point there.
Yes. This Pergamum was a very important religious center and an opulent city. And it was, you know, this altar was understood to be important to the Greek world. Once the Rome took over, the last great king of Pergamum offered this city as a gift to Rome, and it became Rome's administrative capital in Asia Minor. And it continued to, the altar continued to flourish and be of use in the Roman world. Kind of let me place a setting for you, because we kind of miss it when we look at it backwards from the 20th century. We don't see the importance of Pergamum. But if we were to rewind and understand it from the point of view of the Greeks and Romans, this is what we would see. When you were to stand in Asia Minor, let's say some 2,300 years ago, you were standing at the genesis, at the dawn of what would become the great Greco-Roman world, the great Greco-Roman Empire. Historians tell us that the Greco-Roman world began with a few cities in Asia Minor and in Greece. This is where it all started. And so the Persian Empire kind of had its, you know, boundaries around this area, and you know, it never was able to expand past into the Western world. And perhaps, again, the Bible gives us a clue as to why there is this idea in the writings of the prophet Daniel that apparently an angel is coming to give a message to Daniel, and is stopped for 21 days. He's stopped and he's fighting. He tells Daniel, I came 21 days ago to respond to you, but the prince of Persia withstood me, and I have to call for Michael to come down to defend me so I could come and give you this message, and after I have to go and fight the prince of Greece. In this passage, Scripture reveals to us, like removing a veil, that behind these empires there was spiritual forces. These spiritual forces were challenging this heavenly messenger that had come to give a message of scriptural importance. So Pergamum sits essentially not only at the dawn and genesis of the Western world, but it also sits at the boundary of where the power of the prince of Persia ends and the power of the prince of Greece begins.
Now, when you say the prince, you're talking about the spiritual power behind the secular leader of these empires.
They weren't secular because they worshipped these gods. They worshipped these spiritual powers. We see Paul in his great speech where he stands in the city of Ephesus, where it was a very important center of worship of these gods.
So I don't mean secular. I mean human. We have a human leader of the empire, but behind that human leader, they are backed by what? A demonic entity.
Well, yes. I mean, Scripture mentions that many places that the pagans, you know, sacrificed not to gods but to devils. And we see that, for instance, in the association made between Satan and the king of Babylon, the king of Tyre in the Old Testament. We see it when Satan is having a conversation apparently with Jesus. It's his second temptation, and he says to him that all the kingdoms of the world have been given to my dominion. I have dominion over all of the kingdoms of the world, and I will give them to whomever I wish, and if you worship me, I will give them to you. So we see this reality that the fallen man, that the man who is condemned to death and cast out from the presence of God in the Garden of Eden, is then under the legal authority of these beings who are also judged and cast out. And so that's why the Redeemer comes to, you know, purchase things back. Like when Jesus says to Paul, who is a Jewish Pharisee, who is awakened to the fact that this man was really the Messiah, he says to Paul, go into the Roman world and bring people out from the power of Satan to the light of God. And this is in Acts chapter 26 in the New Testament. Again, there is this spiritual freedom that is happening to those who receive this message and who enter into fellowship with the living God, but they're freed from the spiritual forces that govern these empires.
More of my conversation with Ali Siadatan when Conspiracy Unlimited returns.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to be buried in an avalanche?
Weird foreign feeling of despair.
Or how it feels to crash a skydive.
I remember hearing a thud, feeling my body hit the ground.
or how you would react if you were being attacked by an alligator?
At the end of my leg is this huge alligator head on my leg.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a victim of an attack.
Dragging me into the bathroom and saying, I'm going to kill you, now you're going to die.
You'll hear from a man who discovered a baby.
How could this be? How could there be a baby on the ground?
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Clinton County 911.
There's a man at my back door. He's trying to get in.
What Was That Like is a podcast about real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app or at whatwasthatlike.com.
I'm Andrew Gold, a fallen BBC journalist interviewing the heretics and rebels brave enough to speak out against mainstream narratives. Here's Coleman Hughes, John Ronson, and the Trigonometry podcast guys bringing controversy to the fore.
How'd you feel if a person of a different race moved in next door?
I spent a while with a politically correct faction of the Ku Klux Klan.
The system punishes people for wrongthink. It's heartbreaking.
Here's My Unorthodox Life Netflix star Julia Hart on getting out of a Hasidic Jewish cult.
Why can't I be okay with being silent and subservient? Everyone else is.
And biologist Richard Dawkins on trans activism.
It's perfectly legitimate to say, I'm a man, but I feel feminine. But to then say, therefore I am a woman, is just a betrayal of language.
Now it's your turn. Rebel against the mainstream and find a home in this sensible alternative space by subscribing to Heretics Podcast.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Or what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it, and we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Overwhelmed by investing?
If you're anything like us, the hardest part is getting started. That's why we created the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Our goal is to help simplify money so it can work for you.
We invite guests to demystify investing.
At least try to be setting aside like the minimum 10% into the 401k.
We'll teach you the basics of the market.
Yeah, I think compound interest should be at the start of any discussion about investing. And
we've had investment professionals who teach in a simple way.
A valuation-driven bear market, you know, we haven't really seen yet, and I think everyone's thinking about it, but we haven't really seen yet.
Our Q&A episodes feature questions from listeners just like you.
So what do you think about the situation with ETBI, which is Activision?
I'm Dave Ahern.
And I'm Andrew Sather.
And we hope you join us on the Investing for Beginners podcast.
On the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Do you grind your teeth at night? Well, that's not unusual. There are about 40 million Americans who do. We grind our teeth for a lot of reasons. We're stressed and anxious, or maybe because of an unusual bite. Teeth grinding will lead to worn enamel, tooth decay, sleeplessness, and expensive dental procedures. Sure, you could buy a custom-fitted night guard, but that'll set you back $200 or $300, and you'll grind through several of those every year. Instead, try Smile Brilliance Lab Direct Process, and you get the same custom-fitted night guard for as little as $45. That's right, $45 per guard. Smile Brilliant also has custom fitted whitening trays and the Carry Pro electric toothbrush. Smile Brilliant. Take a moment and visit www.smilebrilliant.com and use Conspiracy at checkout to receive 30% off. 30%. www.smilebrilliant.com and use Conspiracy at checkout. Smile fearlessly with Smile Brilliant.
Theoretical physicists say that there is as many as 12 hyperdimensions. Here are just three of them. Conspiracy Unlimited. Conspiracy Unlimited. Conspiracy Unlimited. Pretty cool, huh? Here's an extra one. Conspiracy Unlimited. Hey, how about one more? Conspiracy Unlimited. And the great thing is we have 6 hyperdimensions left. Conspiracy Unlimited.
5.
Hallie Siadatan joins me here on Conspiracy Unlimited. We're talking about the altar of Zeus and whether or not it could be the throne of Satan. If Zeus then is Satan, why Pergamum? I mean, he is the ruler of the world. Why would his throne be there versus, I don't know, pick any other place on the planet?
Rome or Athens.
Exactly.
Yes. Because again, the way we see Pergamum is different from the way that the people in the ancient world saw it. Now that I'm really meditating on the place of Pergamum in the ancient world and looking up all of its archaeological details, I see that it was a very important city. It was very opulent. And as I said, if you were to put your hot tent 2,300 years ago on the shores of the Aegean coast where Pergamum is and look westward, you wouldn't see the Greco-Roman Empire yet, but you would see before you the great lands that would become the Greco-Roman world. It is the genesis. It's like of the empire. It is where the father of the empire has put his house, and he's looking ahead and saying, "This will be my backyard. This will be the territories from which my empires will rise. There'll be many great cities that will rule the world, but it all begins where the territory of the Prince of Persia ends and the Prince of Greece begins. It begins in this Aegean coast. It begins with these small Greek cities. This is the genesis of what eventually, one could even argue, finds its resting place on the shores of California. It is here in the West that the greatest of the powers is to emerge. So Pergamum is at the very dawn, at the very beginning of this. And so from the point of view of these guys who felt that their authority, these emperors, these kings of the Greco-Roman world, who felt that their authority came from Jupiter and from Zeus, they understood that the dream began in places like Pergamum, that as long as they are obeying the god whose altar is there, they will continue to rule out of these various cities.
Okay.
It was more like a spiritual capital rather than an imperial capital.
Let me ask you then, Ali, was this altar, this throne of Satan, simply ceremonial and symbolic, or was there a point when Zeus himself would have sat on the throne there?
Well, I have read that the priests of Zeus would first offer sacrifices on the altar, and if their sacrifice was accepted, they would move up the mountain, and where Zeus himself would then haunt them. His spirit would haunt them, and they would receive communication from him. And this communication was conveyed, you know, to the emperor, for instance. I mean, you look at, let's say, Diocletian. And why were the Roman citizens who believed in the gospel killed? There was no reason to kill them. They weren't saying anything bad. Well, they were killed because the emperors felt that this was something that was completely understood in the ancient world, going back to the earliest kings of Mesopotamia, that the power of the king came from the gods. And these citizens were weakening the empire and the emperor by refusing to sacrifice to the gods. So in the case of Diocletian, who in the 4th century carried the most significant persecution against the Christian citizenry, he started that by first sending a messenger to the oracle of Apollo in Delphi, asking, "What should I do with the Christians?" And Apollo responded that the Christians are the enemies of the gods. And this is what led to the civil rights of Christian citizens being suspended, their Bibles being burnt, and they were arrested and tortured until they sacrificed to the gods or died. But the command came from the Pantheon. And of course, Apollo is the sun god whom we know as Shamps. He's the one who gave the code of Hammurabi. He has had many different names, you know, but the symbol is always that of the sun. And Zeus, you know, the head of the Pantheon, he is the prince of the power of the air, the thunder god, the one who has the power of lightning in his hands. And there are many names, but the symbols are the same. And so this altar was a place of worship and also a place of communication.
Now, Zeus's symbol also was an eagle, was it not?
Exactly. And where do we see the eagle? where we see the eagle in all of the imperial flags, and then going forward into the West, you look at why was placed in Germany, and we see it, of course, we see the eagle in all of the significant flags that grew out of the new Greco-Roman world, which is Europe and the Americas. Go back now to the fall of the Roman Empire in the 4th century. As in the West, Rome begins to fall, what rises in its stead? Well, there's the Visigoths, the Germanic tribes that are coming. They're finishing Rome off. And suddenly, they become the new power. They become the dawn of a new world. And so the first empire is the Charlemagne's empire, which is a Germanic empire. Charlemagne is a Germanic king, and he creates the Holy Roman Empire. And from there, we see a succession of five main powers rising. There is the Kingdom of Portugal, the Kingdom of Spain, then Napoleon rises, the French rise, and at Waterloo, the British begin to rise, and so Charlemagne, the Portuguese, the Spanish, the French, and then the English. And they form five empires, which may be very well these five toes that we read about in the ancient prophecies of Scripture. From here, the Europe conquers the New World and seeds it and extends its imperial reach into the New World. And of course, there's lots of interesting writings about the Washington D.C., how it was selected by the secret societies, and it was Albert Pike, Lord Bacon. There's so many writings that say we have handpicked this place, and so out of the Fifth Empire, the English one, D.C. rises. And so once again, Berlin, or the Germanic power, is, like Pergamum, at the dawn of what eventually is going to become the Western civilization and the Western.
Well, the United States was equally British and German. There was only a number of votes, I believe, at the Continental Congress to decide the official language of the United States, and it could well have been, given another couple of votes, it could have been German.
Well, there you go. So between the Germans to the north and the Celts to the south, the Germans will always dominate the history of Europe. And also, it's interesting to note that when the European Union was formed, on the euro, we see the symbol of a bull, which is the symbol of Zeus, lifting Europa out of the sea, which was a princess. And so we see that what is lifting Europe out of the sea is Zeus.
Satan.
Yes, as far as this biblical insight is concerned. So in this thinking, Europe becomes the new Greece and the Americas the new Rome. So the Greco-Roman world gets duplicated. And so, again, if you stand in Pergamum and look westward, which is the temple, the altar of Pergamum faces west with its arms open towards the west. If you right now went to Pergamum and stood in the middle of that altar and looked out directly, you would be looking directly towards the west. And that's what I'm saying. This was the vision.
Got it. Okay.
It's in this direction. And the Germanic world, once again, is at the beginning of a new imperial power. So the throne is squarely put in the west and has made its reappearance. Now, what is
it's still in Berlin, correct? It's still in Berlin. It hasn't moved there since the late 19th century.
Well, no, Berlin was conquered by the Soviet army.
Right.
And this thing was what inside of what was East Berlin, eventually became East Berlin. So the altar passed from the Germans for a while to the Russians. And it was taken to Moscow. And the Soviet Empire rose and became this great atheistic empire that really, yes, the West is imperial, yes, but the Soviet Empire had this, two qualities about it. One was its anti-Semitic pogroms that started, and two, it was an atheist empire that declared war against the very existence of God and created all kinds of contentions. So for a while, the altar was in Moscow, and then it was brought back to Berlin, to its resting place. And the Soviet Empire fell, and now we are to see what may rise from it, but it is squarely in the Western world. Also, I think it's very interesting to talk about what is actually depicted on the altar.
All right.
What is depicted on the altar is the story of the rise of the Titans, which is these hybrid offsprings of heaven and earth, of the gods and men. They rise, the Titans rise, and then they are they create chaos in the world, and then Zeus, the just, arrives with his, you know, gods and with his buddies, and he then defeats the Titans and reestablishes order in the world. Now, this is interesting because the biblical narrative gives us the exact opposite understanding of history, that it was the fallen angels who created these Titans, these Nephilim, the Hebrew calls them, before the age of the flood, that these guys rose to create a one world empire, one world government, and there was a Nephilim who was the leader of them all, and some even believe that he ruled out of the city of Atlantis. And this was then judged eventually by the flood, by God, and the flood came and purified the earth, washed it away, and the age of chaos was removed, and then afterwards an age of order was introduced, and God began to introduce his order by revealing himself through Abraham, through the Torah, through the prophets, and eventually came as a person. So God is the order bringer. But in this altar, what we see is the reverse. What we see is that what is represented on this altar is that it is Zeus who is the bringer of order out of chaos. He's bringing order through the vehicle of empire.
It's the first, Ali, it's the first instance of fake news.
Yes, it's a massive fake news. He is to his worshippers, which were massive. The Greeks tell us people in all nations worship Zeus. That they understood him as telegraphed on the history written on this, that this is, in fact, he is the one bringing order. And so, therefore, he's directly competing with the line of, you know, with the Temple of Jerusalem, which is supposed to be this place where the light is and where the order emanates from, and, of course, the line of David, which is leading to, you know, this ruler, this king, who is going to bring an age of peace on the earth.
Right. We're just about out of time here. So I want to ask you, has the altar now, I guess, is back in Berlin, correct?
Yes.
Has it ever been replicated again by some world leader in the same way that Albert Speer replicated it for Hitler's Nuremberg rally?
Well, President Obama was in Berlin, and he was there to give a speech, and he was kind of walking up to where the speech was going to happen. He went into the museum, and he also fell under its spell, and he said, "I want my inauguration speech," and it's a very strange request. "I want my inauguration speech to be done from a replica of this altar," and this was in 2008, and you can Google this, and they've built a small replica of the altar from where Obama does his inauguration speech. Now, remember something very important, that in the time of the Greeks, when the Greek Empire was, like, after Alexander, was still very much flourishing, one of the leaders of the Greek Empire, Antiochus Epiphanes, decided that he was going to come and take over Jerusalem, and he forced everyone to sacrifice to Zeus, and he then went in the Holy of Holies, where apparently God's presence was descending once a year on the Day of Atonement, and there he sacrificed a pig on the altar, which was, you know, very a no-no, and he erected an idol to Zeus in the Holy of Holies, fulfilling a prophecy of the prophet Daniel, who said that there'll be an abomination of desolation that will render the temple desolate for 3.5 years. And this was fulfilled in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. And what Jesus did was very interesting. He resurrected this prophecy by saying, "When you see the abomination of desolation," pointing to this event now being a type of a future event that hasn't yet occurred. Suddenly, this historical event that involved Zeus and the quenching of the light in the temple is mentioned by Daniel, is resurrected by Jesus in Matthew chapter 24, and he makes it a type of a future event that has not yet occurred. So once again, there will be a power that will be strong enough and will come to Jerusalem and will lay claim to it for the forces of darkness.
Okay, so let's just let me jump in here and let's go back to Obama here for a second.
So what does Obama do? after he becomes president? Well, let's be frank. President Obama, despite all the great things he may have done, and this is not a political statement, it's just a factual statement, he does begin to roll back some of the values of the Judeo-Christian culture of the United States and champions values that are different. And that was the kind of world inside of which the story of Hanukkah occurred. It was a world in which many of the Jewish people had left their scriptural values, and they were ripe for the many of the, even the priests agreed with the worship of Zeus in Jerusalem. And I think that is the type of world in which the Antichrist will rise. It will not be the kind of world that doesn't know God, but it will be the kind of world that once knew God and has left it. Because when you're an Antichrist, it means you are competing with something that has to do with Christ. So the Judeo-Christian world, the Western world, where the throne is, has to culturally also be prepared for the rise of this man. And this is for sure why the altar has reappeared, because it has reappeared in expectation for the rise of the Antichrist. Now, if we zoom into the middle of the altar, to where the burnt offerings were put, not the outside wall, but the burnt offering, what is there depicted on there? There is depicted the life of Caiaphas, the founder of Pergamum, the grandson of Zeus through the line of Hercules, a serpent seed line, a Nephilim line. In the middle of the altar, there is the life of Caiaphas recorded. Caiaphas was a son of Hercules, who was the son of Zeus. So what is the city was founded, if you take these stories to be literal, the city was founded by a Nephilim in the very bloodline of Zeus. And so not only is the altar telegraphing that the father of the gods is the bringer of order and light through the vehicle of empire, but that his bloodline is the one that deserves to be the rulership of the world, one who is a representative, a type of the coming world leader. And it's Caiaphas who's represented there, a king, the founder of the city of Pergamum, but not a human king, a king who's part human and part God, and part God specifically in the line of Zeus. So that is also, I think, symbolically very important. When this altar was placed there, it had in its writing, in its depictions, the dream of Satan to compete with the house of David and with the temple of Jerusalem. And that's why we see the Greco-Roman world make war with the temple of Jerusalem, and the Roman world eventually destroys the temple of Jerusalem in 70 AD and puts in its stead a temple to the gods, to Jupiter. A temple to Jupiter is put in Jerusalem in 135 AD. The name of the city is changed to Capitalina, Aelina Capitalina, which means the city of the Capitoline gods. And it is believed that this temple to Jupiter had an octagonal base. And that's why when the Muslims came in the 7th century and destroyed it, and they built the Golden Dome, the mosque, they built it in the octagonal shapes. But I mean, it's interesting that under the Greco-Roman world, under the leadership of Zeus or Jupiter, we see attempts against the temple in Jerusalem, and we see Jesus, saying that these attempts are prophetic, and that they're actually acting out future events in history, that once again the temple will be desolate for 3.5 years, and these 3.5 years will be the last 3.5 years of history itself, leading to the second coming.
Right.
This is where the 3.5 years even comes from. It comes from the prophecies of Daniel about the desolation of abomination, which until the time of Jesus, everyone believed was fulfilled
right.
by now, one of Alexander's generals
okay.
when he erected an altar to Zeus in the Holy of Holies.
Now, back to the altar of Zeus. I want to go back to Obama here. Did no one notice that when he was delivering his inaugural address before this replica of the altar of Zeus, did no one say, hey, that looks familiar. I saw that in Triumph of the Will. Did no one notice?
No one knows these things. But what is happening right now is that attention is being brought to it. I know that, for instance, Rabbi Jonathan Cahn is talking about these things. I'm talking about these things. I've now seen other mentions of it online. So I think it takes time for awareness to spread. I was sharing this with a Jewish friend of mine. You know, he's a 74-year-old man. And when I showed the connection between this altar and the Nazis and Obama, it had a very profound effect on him. When we met again, that's the first thing that came out of his mouth. So I realized that for him, this did telegraph something about the heart of President Obama that went beyond words. It is as though something in the subconscious was being broadcasted out, something deep inside of his being, that he too could be a vehicle. And what, as I said, what is it that he bring? Well, some will say he weakened Israel and made alliances with the enemies of Israel. Others will say he, you know, pushed back the Judeo-Christian makeup of the culture and prepared the way for all kinds of other ideas to take root in the culture. Who knows? You know, time will tell. With hindsight, we'll see it more clearly. But it is very interesting.
I'll say. One final question. The Altar of Zeus remains in this museum in Berlin.
Yes.
Will it play some role in the end of days? Will Satan once again sit on his throne, wherever it may be, whether it's in Berlin or Pergamum?
Well, it's a place of worship. Maybe at night, maybe in sometimes during the year, maybe there are ceremonies there that we don't know about. I sometimes imagine that because of the shape of it. But what it does tell us is that squarely it seems that it is this new Greco-Roman world, the Western world, that is the one selected to be the seat of ultimate power. And we do see it, that it is the most powerful part of the world, regardless of all the noise. So I think that it is from this part of the world that the Antichrist may rise. Now, will he rise out of Berlin? Will he rise out of D.C.? As you pointed out yourself, Pergamum was where the altar was, where the statement of rulership was made, where the worship was done. But the imperial power came out of other cities like Athens and Rome. So power could rise out of D.C., but I think at this point, I have to say, with this new shocking revelation, I do favor Berlin or D.C. as where this power may rise out of. I have to say that this is very interesting.
To say the least. Ali, yes. This is fascinating. Thank you so much for bringing this to light, the Altar of Zeus.
You're welcome, Richard.
Okay, before I dim the lights in my little studio beneath the stairs, I'll be back in a moment with a few words about an upcoming episode. C60 Evo delivers the miracle molecule, ESS60. It's pure carbon-60. Why not love your body and share C60 Evo with those you love? ESS60 from C60 Evo is a mega antioxidant for increased strength, endurance, flexibility, and a deeper sleep. It's great for pets too. I take a tablespoon every day, and so does the mighty Aphrodite. We're both sleeping better than we have in years. And during the day, we have such tremendous energy and vitality. We're both pain-free. In a landmark peer-reviewed animal study in Paris, France, rats fed ESS60 lived twice their normal lifespan. Go to c60evo.com/Richard-Serrett or click on the C60 Evo link in the episode notes. Use the code EVRS at checkout and save 10%. ESS60 from C60 Evo. Order your miracle in a bottle today. Coming up next time, an inventor discusses a new breakthrough exotic technology that may hold the key to eliminating all toxic exhaust fumes that will allow internal combustion engines to run pollution-free. Until then, I'm Richard Serrett. So long for now.
A new Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Your mind. That is all for now. Oh, and remember to share and give a 5-star review because we have huge egos and need love. We're like cats. We need constant petting.